said, cultivate our motivation. I said, cultivate a motivation, not move. People seem to think that cultivate a motivation means you wiggle. So we have a precious human life that's the result of a tremendous amount of good karma we created in the past. But having that precious human life really isn't sufficient. It's still a life within samsara, psychic existence. It's one that is impermanent, that is going to end. So in and of itself, it's not really a big deal, especially if we just enjoy the pleasures of this life and use up the store of good karma that we accumulated from previous times. But what is a big deal is what we can do with our life, what we can do with this opportunity. And that means to put our mind into the Dharma, to put our life into the Dharma. And practicing the Dharma doesn't mean wearing certain clothes, speaking Tibetan, doing pujas, ringing bells, drinking blessed water while wearing blessed cords, having a beautiful altar and all this kind of stuff. Those are external props that are meant to inspire our practice, but the real practice is what goes on in our mind. So the real practice is watching the mind, being aware of when harmful emotions or intentions arise, and applying your antidotes, and also cultivating our good qualities, transforming the mind into wisdom and compassion, into goodness. So doing that is what makes having a precious human life meaningful and worthwhile. Otherwise, if we just have it but don't make use of it, it's like having something very delicious to eat, but you throw it out before you eat it. So one of the best things to do with our life is to cultivate the bodhicitta intention, this motivation to attain full enlightenment in order to best be able to benefit sentient beings. And so it's to generate that intention that we're here, and then to act with that intention by developing wisdom. So let's set that motivation clearly in our mind so that we know why we're here and what we're doing. And in that way we can stay focused, we can stay on target. Okay, so we were talking about the four distortions. Okay, those four forms of sulmanicca or inappropriate attention. So I was saying that in my way of thinking, it seems like these are innate. They arise just in all sentient beings. And then in addition, we develop philosophies about them. And that gives us the acquired level of them. Okay, so just in our daily life, you know, seeing impermanent things as permanent, seeing our world as stable, you know, seeing, yeah, we see everything very stable, predictable, okay, and then we develop a philosophy about it that we use to comfort ourselves and each other, and we say, don't worry, it's all going to be all right, mm-hmm. Yeah, so-and-so's not going to die. What? They're going to be the first sentient being who was born under the influence of afflictions and karma who doesn't die? Excuse me? You know? But do you see how we kind of say things to ourselves like that are, you know, completely nonsensical, really. You know? of course somebody's going to die. We don't know if they're going to die of what they're sick with right now, but of course they're going to die. We're going to die. Okay? But we can kind of, you know, soothe it over with these ways of describing things to ourselves. Okay? Seeing what is unclean is clean, you know, how we think our body is just kind of this most magnificent thing that ever came along, you know, and we treasure our body. And then look at the advertising industry. If you want to see how we get so much acquired affliction about this body, you know. I mean, everything just gets pumped up and you know, made to be the best thing in the world, and we buy into it, you know. Of course, we're Buddhist practitioners, so we go, well, the advertising industry just does that, and it's all nonsense. But I'm going to go in and see if my eyeliner's right, and I'm getting a little gray. I better dye my hair before I go to the next retreat. And you know? So we fall prey to it, just like everybody else. Okay? And then seeing what is dukkha by nature as happiness. Yeah, things that are unsatisfactory that, you know, we think are going to be the ultimate in satisfaction. And again, look at our society and what we're told is the meaning of our life. What we're told is going to bring us happiness. You know? And this is all, you know, tied in with having a good economy and being a successful person is buying into this view of what happiness is. And if you think that happiness is other than what the advertising industry and the middle class is telling you, then people think you're really quite weird. Yeah? What do you mean you don't buy Christmas presents? It's not being a good citizen. You have to support the American economy. Yeah? Buy Christmas presents and all of this stuff. Okay? So if you want to do anything a little bit different, if your version of happiness is a little bit different, people really think you're quite peculiar. And then, of course, we believe them. Oh, dear, maybe I am peculiar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I don't want to be peculiar. I don't want to be left. I don't want to be different from everybody else. I mean, I know they're all samsaric sentient beings, and therefore full of faults, and the Buddha's the perfect one who I want to be like. But actually, for right now, I better really do what all these sentient beings do, because the Buddha's kind of far away, and maybe he slipped up a little bit, you know? Maybe the sentient beings know better what happiness is than the Buddha knows. Yeah. We kind of have that, you know, somewhere in our mind. You know, Buddha's far away, and he's not really in touch with what's happening in America nowadays, anyway. You know, he doesn't know the kind of pressure that's on me, you know, to conform. And if he did, I'm sure, you know, that he would agree that buying a new car and having a Christmas tree and going on holiday and, you know, using more than my fair share of the world's resources and driving all these places, polluting the planet, I'm sure the Buddha would think that that was happiness. Okay? So, you know, another example of our philosophy. Okay, and then the fourth distortion is seeing what doesn't have a self as having a self. Now, if we explain this from the prasangika viewpoint, okay, here self refers to self-existence or inherent existence. So this fourth one from the prasangika viewpoint would be thinking that things that don't have inherent existence or true existence have that, and it really exists in that way. Okay? So this is what appears to us, this is what we grasp onto, and what we then believe in and make philosophies about. The question came up if we always if we always grasp at true existence. Now I was thinking it's important to explain reference to that question that there's three ways of apprehending phenomena. Okay, there's apprehending them or grasping at them as truly existent, apprehending them as non-truly existent, and apprehending them in neither way. If we apprehend them as true existence, this is what all the consciousnesses of sentient beings up to and including the 10th level bodhisattvas or the non-returners, except sentient beings who are in meditative equipoise, directly realizing emptiness. All other consciousnesses of sentient beings, inherent existence appears to them, but we don't always grasp them as inherently existent. Okay, so don't write it down wrong, okay? I'm not saying that all the consciousnesses except meditative equipoise and emptiness grasp inherent existence, okay? If that inherent existence appears to them, then it's very easy from that to grasp at inherent existence, okay? So when we see that piece of chocolate cake, you know, and attachments arising, how is that attachment arising? Because we're seeing that chocolate cake as inherently existent. And then based on that, then the inappropriate attention is exaggerating it. Okay? Whenever our feelings are hurt, yeah, oh, I'm so hurt, I'm so offended, somebody doesn't like me, they put me down, they criticize me, they told me what to do, you know, whatever it is, how we're perceiving the I at that point, we're grasping an inherent existence. Because there's a very strong feeling of me that comes up at that time. Okay? When somebody takes our stuff, okay, my china that was passed down to me from my grandma and grandpa, my china. Okay, so the my is inherently existent and the china is inherently existent. Okay? So whenever we have, you know, like some strong emotion on the negative side underlying that, there's going to be grasping an inherent existence. We also can grasp an inherent existence when we have a positive mental state. I'm going to make this beautiful offering to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay? I'm going to make this really beautiful offering. Isn't this a gorgeous offering? Okay? So it's a virtuous mind that's offering, but still, you know, the eye is a little bit big, and the beauty of the thing that we're offering is big. Okay? You know where we also grasp it in here in existence is when we talk about the incarnations of our teachers. Okay? You know, here's the incarnation of so-and-so, you know, and we think that it's the exact same person, just in a different body. It's not the exact same person. Mm. Yeah? And I really saw this, like when Mama Yeshe passed away, you know, and they found Lama Osa. You know, everybody's like relating to Lama Osa as if he were Lama Yeshe. Well, he's not. The aggregates of Lama Yeshe cease. Okay, the aggregates of Lama Osel began after that. Okay, but people were expecting Lama Osel to have the same personality as Lama Yeshe. Okay, of course he doesn't. Yeah. So you look like the 13th and the 14th Dalai Lama, totally different personalities. I never didn't know the 13th, but from what I hear about it, very different personalities. You know, but so often, When we think about the incarnations of teachers, we grasp them as if there's a real person there, okay, that just kind of picked up out of one body and plunked down into another body. It's not like that, okay? So there's all sorts of different ways in which this grasping at inherent existence comes up. And you know, that can be a virtuous way if you, you know, meet the incarnation of your teacher and have some feeling or some respect, that's a virtuous mind, but it still could be based on self-grasping. Okay? Because you don't feel that way about another child who acts in exactly the same way. Remember when poor Lama Osa went to Singapore, he was maybe, like 3 years old. And, you know, you know how 3-year-olds are. And everybody's going, oh, look, he moved his hand. Oh, look, he's eating rice. You know, it was like everything was this big deal. You know? And I thought, wow. You know? People are just kind of projecting a lot on this child who is, you know, I mean, the continuation of Lama, but it's, you know, also a three-year-old and, you know, not the same personality. Anyway, so there's virtuous states of mind in which there can be grasping and inherent existence. Okay? The second way of apprehending things is apprehending them as non-inherent existence. So this occurs in meditative equipoise on emptiness. Okay? And it also occurs when Aryas arise from that meditative equipoise on emptiness and see things as like illusions. Okay, so this one's kind of more, it's more the way, more restricted to how Aryas perceive things. Aryas are those who have realized emptiness directly. Okay, so they're meditative equipoise, they see things are empty, but they lack inherent existence. When they arise from that, then things appear as like an illusion. In other words, appearing truly existent, but they're not apprehending them as truly existent. They're apprehending them as like an illusion. In other words, they know that that's a false appearance. And then the third way of apprehending phenomena is neither way. And so a lot of our daily life apprehensions are like this. You know, you walk in and you say, here's a bell and here's a cup and here's this and here's that. And at that moment, you know, our mind is just having a conventional valid cognizer that on a conventional level can identify the object correctly. Okay? So when we say, you know, that's a thermos and those are carrots and, you know, we're just able to cognize the object correctly. There's no strong grasping at them. You know, if we go, those are the carrots that I want, you know, and I want them chopped in this way, not in that way, then we've gone into grasping of the inherent existence of the carrots, okay? But when we're just saying those are carrots, or I'm walking, I'm thinking, you know, we're not apprehending the self, the person, as either inherently existent or as non-inherently existent. Okay, that's an example of neither way. Okay, so back to this thing of apprehending, the grasping, apprehending things that lack a self as having a self. Okay, so that's, you know, when we're imputing this inherent existence onto them. Okay, so what is inherent existence? It's seeing that things that arise dependently, we're seeing those things, or apprehending, grasping those things which arise dependently as having their own inherent independent essence. Okay? We're apprehending them as existing in their own reality, separate from the causes and conditions that produce them, separate from the basis of designation or the parts, independence upon which they're labeled, and also separate from the mind and the label, the conceptual mind and the label that is, designating them. Okay, so inherent existence is thinking that there's some existence there from the side of the object that is beyond what is merely labeled. When you look at it, merely labeled, there's nothing there, you know. It's like there's the label that is given in dependence upon the base, you know, but that label is given by the conceptual mind, and there's nothing from the side of the base that is that object. And this is actually the difference between the Svatantrika Madhyamikas and the Prasangika Madhyamikas. Both of them say that the object is labeled. But the Svatantrikas say there's something from the side of the object that makes you label it what it is. Because if there wasn't, you could call anything anything. And the Prasangikas say, well, that's fine, but find it. Find what exists there from the side of the label, or from the side of the base that is independent of the mind and the term that's being imputed on it. Okay? And we see this when we meditate on emptiness, you know? It's like we can go through, I'm not my body, I'm not my mind. Oh yeah, the I is just merely labeled. There's no I in the body and mind. Well, wait a minute. There has to be. Otherwise, I wouldn't be me. Otherwise, I would be somebody else. There has to be something that's really me in there. So yeah, sure, yeah, you know, my name is labeled, you know, Sue or Harry or whatever it is. That's labeled. But there's something in there that exists without being labeled. Okay? So that's the Svatantrika viewpoint. You know, that there's something appearing from the side of the object that makes it a valid base upon which you can label it this. Okay? But when you try it, you know, Prasangika say, well, try and find that thing that exists there independently, that makes that thing what it is, and you can't find it. But our mind sometimes feels very restless, very groundless, thinking that things exist only by being merely labeled. We really want there to be something there. Okay? So now we see why the lower tenant systems are so popular. You know? Because they really support what we feel in our own heart, which is, yeah, there's something really there. Okay? So what we think is really there, you know, sometimes it's this, you know, what we think is really there is something that we're innately grasping at, some kind of something in there that's me. And sometimes what we're grasping at is something much grosser. It's the acquired affliction, the acquired self-grasping. And this is from the philosophies that we develop. Okay? So for example, we think that there's a soul. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see, across the world, most religions assert a soul, don't they? It's very comforting to think that there's a soul. Now, there's something that's really me, that's permanent, immutable, unchanging. My body might fall apart. My personality might decay, but I'm still there. And this immutable soul is something that can never, ever be harmed. Because it's permanent. It's independent of everything else. It's the essence of meaning. Okay? And we develop a whole religion about it. Okay? Most religions have this idea of the soul. Okay? Or another version of it is instead of calling it soul, you call it self with a capital S. Okay? And I've got to discover my true self. Okay, here we're getting into New Age jargon, but, you know, there's also long-term religions that have this idea of self, too. There's a true self. You know, my anger's not me, my attachment's not me, all my negativities aren't me. But there's a true self in there. And you know, some people even misapprehend what Buddha nature is and think of Buddha nature as being some kind of true self. Okay? We all have Buddha nature. There's all something within us that was uncreated, that is the very nature of our mind, that can never disappear, that has the possibility to become a Buddha. And that's true. But what we add on to it is, there's the essence of me-ness. There's something that's really me. Okay, I'm not all these other things, but I'm my Buddha nature. Okay? But when you really understand what Buddha nature is, you know, there's two kinds of Buddha nature. We'll get into that later. But one kind is the emptiness of the mind. So to say the emptiness is really me, is an oxymoron. Okay. It's a total oxymoron. Okay. So there's so many ways in which, you know, we want something to really be there, and we develop philosophies about it. You know? Or we develop this idea of a cosmic consciousness. There's one big mind, and we are all just little blips off of this one big mind. And after we die, we all reabsorb into this cosmic consciousness. Okay. But there's still something that's really me in there that reabsorbs into this inherently existent cosmic consciousness. Or in the Chittamatra school, yeah, the mind-only school, there's this thing called the storehouse consciousness. Yeah, because, you know, there's always this challenge in Buddhist philosophy is if you say that there's no inherently existent person, what is it that carries the karma from one life to the next? So then Chittamatra says it's the storehouse consciousness. Yeah, it's this mind basis of all, alaya vijnana. Yeah, and this is a neutral state of mind, and all the karmic seeds are placed there, and that goes from one life to the next. So that's, you know, again, something stable, something, you know, independent, inherently existent. Okay, so even within Buddhism, we see, you know, and the lower schools might say, well, the mental consciousness goes from life to life. That's what the real person is. Yeah. So we, you know, we always have some philosophy in there because somehow it's very soothing to our ego grasping to think that there's really something there. Okay, it's very disconcerting when we start to think that from the side of the base there's nothing there. Okay. So that's why we see the development of all these various philosophies, and then these philosophies all have their reasons that support why they assert that there's something at the end of the day that really is the person. And within Buddhism and also the non-Buddhist philosophies that believe in karma, the main reason is that you need something that's really there in order to carry the karma. There's nothing really there, then the karma can't be carried from from one life to the next, you know, in which case everything would be chaotic, you know, because I could do something and you would experience the karma and vice versa. But the Prasangika school actually says that it's because things are empty and there's nothing there from the side of the aggregates that is the person. It's because the person is empty that therefore karma can function and karma can go from one life to the next. Mm-hmm. So then the other schools say, well, what is it that carries the karma from one life to the next? And the Prasangika say, the mere I. Well, what is the mere I? The lower schools ask. And the Prasangika say, that which is merely labeled independence upon the aggregate. Mm. So there we are. There's nothing there from the side of the aggregate. It's what exists by being merely labeled. Now you'll see that what the aggregates are change all the time. Our aggregates, you know, the form aggregate, our body, and then we have feeling, discernment or discrimination, compositional factors, sometimes translated as volition, and then primary consciousnesses. Those are the four mental aggregates. Okay, so those are sometimes just called mind in brief. Okay, so we think somewhere within the body and mind there's something that's really the person. But if you look, the body and mind are constantly changing. Okay, we talked about this the other day. You know, everything that is caused is ceasing. It's arising, abiding, and ceasing simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Nothing exists for a second moment. So whatever the aggregates are, it's always changing. So whatever the base is that we're labeling I, the base is always changing. Because we give the same label to this base that's changing moment by moment, we think that there's something that's really there in the base, or something permanent, something that you can find. But when you search, there's nothing that you can find. Okay? So I think that using the example of a river is really helpful here. Okay? You think of the think of Mississippi. Okay? Our big American river. We have somebody from New Orleans, so better say Mississippi here. Okay? So there's the Mississippi. We say Mississippi. We are in our mind, we feel like there's one river, don't we? One river that is the Mississippi. Yeah, it's not the Spokane River. It's not the Volga River. It's the Mississippi. Okay? But if we start to look a little bit more closely, yeah, what actually is the Mississippi? Okay? Is it the rocks on the edge? Is it the dirt on the edge? Is it the silt flowing in it? Is it the water that's flowing in it? Okay? Can we identify any of those things as being the river? All those things are parts of the river, but they aren't the river. Okay. Is the Mississippi the river that it starts where, in Wisconsin or Minnesota? Minnesota? Okay. So is it the part that's in Minnesota? Is it the part that goes through Illinois and Iowa?
Ohio.
Ohio? Let's see, what's another river?
Columbia.
But I know it forms the border between Illinois and St. Louis. That I know. Okay, and you know. Anyway, but which part is the Mississippi? Okay? You know? Can you isolate one part in one of the states and say that part is the Mississippi? Okay. When you start to look, you can't find anything there that's the Mississippi in any of the parts. Okay? Now, does that mean the Mississippi is non-existent? No, the Mississippi's there. It flooded. Okay? We all know that. It exists. But there's nothing findable there that we can point to and say is it. Yet, and here it is going back to the analogy with the mind stream, what carries the karma. If a leaf falls in the Mississippi when it's in Minnesota, that leaf can float down all the way to New Orleans, can't it? Okay? You can't find the Mississippi in any of the places where that leaf is floating down. But that leaf still manages to get from the source in Minnesota down to New Orleans. Even though there's no findable Mississippi there. And the leaf itself, too, isn't totally findable because it's changing moment by moment itself. Maybe when it fell in Minnesota, it was green. And then it's staying in the water and it's changing, you know. There's a continuity of the leaf, but the leaf is not the same thing. That fell in, the leaf that fell in Minnesota and wound up in New Orleans, it's not the same leaf. Or another way to look at it, you know, to help you see how we get the label confused with the base is you say Newport. We'll use our local town, okay? Newport. And we all say Newport as if we all know what Newport is. You know, and in a conventional way, if you say I'm going into Newport, everybody knows where you're going. But what really is Newport? Yeah? Is it First Street? Is it Second Street? Yeah? Is it the drugstore with the soda fountain? Is it the real estate offices? Is it Create? Is it what is Newport? Okay. Or is Newport the people? Okay. The people are, some people live there and then they move out, don't they? Okay. Some buildings are there and then they get torn down. Or something's an empty lot and then they build a new building on it. We still call it Newport, but the base that we're calling Newport is in constant flux, isn't it? Yeah, buildings are being demolished, buildings are being created, people are moving in, people are moving out. Yeah. So the base that we're calling Newport is not anything fixed or findable. And yet we just give it that, you know, Newport's existed since, when was it, like the end of last century sometime? Mm-hmm. No, the end of the 19th century sometime, you know? So it's existed since then, but boy, what we've labeled Newport then and what we label Newport now are totally different. And yet there's a continuity. So even though you can't find Newport when you look for it, that's looking with ultimate analysis, looking for an ultimate nature to Newport, even though you can't find that. On a conventional level, we can say that Newport has existed for 100 and something years, and we're going to Newport. Okay? So it's the same thing with the aggregates. The aggregates are in constant flux. And, you know, I don't think any of us would think that our body would carry our karma into the next life. That's pretty obvious. The body just, you know, gets buried and recycled or burnt or whatever happens. But then we tend to think, oh, the mind is, the person is somewhere really inside the mind. Maybe it's the mental consciousness, maybe it's the storehouse consciousness. It's something there that carries the karma to the next life. But actually, you know, what we call mind is just one moment after the next moment. Sometimes there's gross levels of mind, sometimes there's subtle levels of mind, sometimes there's extremely subtle levels of mind. There's so many different bases in dependence upon which we can label I, or person. There's a continuity between all those different levels of mind, isn't there? There's some relationship and there's some continuity. But none of those things individually can be pointed to and say, that's me. That's the stable person. That's what carries the karma. Okay? So that's why the Prasangika say it's the mere I that carries the karma. But our mind that grasps inherent existence feels extremely uncomfortable saying that. Because there's nothing to point to that's the mere I. And we want something you can point to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's that same thing. It's like, what are you going to point to as Newport? Is it City Hall? You know, I don't think so. Okay. So it's this mind that grasps at a self where there isn't a self. That's the fourth distortion. And that's the one that's the root of samsara. Okay, because it's from that the afflictions arise, you know, that the inappropriate attention arises, that the afflictions arise, that the karma arises, that produce the dukkha. Okay, so that's the real culprit, and that's precisely why realizing emptiness is so important. Okay, because if we can realize that things exist in the opposite way from how ignorance, the self-grasping ignorance, grasps them as existing, then we can decrease that self-grasping ignorance, yeah, and eventually eliminate it altogether because it has a faulty basis, because it's a misapprehension. And so that is why it's possible to attain liberation, you know, why liberation isn't just some kind of fanciful way of thinking or, you know, something somebody invented to make us all feel better. You know, it's something that's an actual possibility because things are empty of inherent existence. Yeah.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Talking about that, you know, what is with the eyes, and then the mere eye represents a state that carry the karma. My question is the mind is, well, first, my first question is this grasping of an eye or a self, a mental factor?
Yes.
Okay. So is this mental factor, the grasp to an existing self, that the one that is carried life after life and carries the karma also? Is that what you were saying? What did I say? Is the grasping of the I or of the self the one that carries the karma from one life to the other?
Okay. So you're asking what exactly is...
This mere eye that carries it.
Well, that, as you see, you can't find the mere eye. The mere eye is what exists by being merely labeled in dependence upon whatever aggregates happen to be there at the moment.
Can we say then that it is the habit of the mind that carries this self-grasping?
No. the self-grasping, you know, what we call self-grasping, what we call ignorance, is not an inherently existent thing either. Mm-hmm. Okay? What we call ignorance is just a number of moments of mind that have a similar quality. Okay? We call that ignorance. It's easier sometimes to think about it if we talk about anger, okay? When we say, sometimes we'll say, I'm an angry person, or we say that about somebody, somebody's an angry person, or we say, I have repressed anger. Okay, we're taught to say that, aren't we? Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody here have repressed anger? Mm-hmm. You know, we're all supposed to have it. The psychobabble tells us we all have repressed anger. Okay, so then we have this identity, oh, I have repressed anger, yeah? So we think of this anger as this thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's like my repressed anger is somewhere, I'm not quite sure where, but it's, you know, it's my repressed anger, and you know, and I have to get it out to be psychologically healthy. Well, what else? Go find your repressed anger. What in the world is your repressed anger? Can you find something that is your repressed anger?
Maybe memories.
Memories or anger? Memories aren't necessarily the mental factor of anger. You could have memories and not be angry. Memories are just appearances to the mind. They aren't the emotion of anger. When you start looking for all this repressed anger we're supposed to have, because they tell us we have it, what do you find?
It's the habit that is triggered sometimes.
There's just, you know, you might look and say, well, I have the mental factor of anger. But again, the mental factor of my anger isn't something that's there. It's not like sitting in here, all my mental factor of anger, all my repressed anger. It's sitting there, ready to go, boom, you know? This is the image we have, isn't it? Don't we have this image? You know, my, it's just right there, ready to surface at any moment and splatter all over everybody. But what is our repressed anger? I mean, what do we call anger? We only give the label anger to certain aspects of the mind, certain momentary aspects of the mind that arise based on exaggerating negative qualities or projecting negative qualities that aren't there, that have the you know, conventional nature of feeling repelled to the repelled versus, you know, that object that they're exaggerating. On the basis of a few different moments of mind here and there that have that quality of being based on the inappropriate attention exaggerating negativity and having the nature of, you know, wanting to flee or attack, then we give the label anger. But all anger is something that's labeled in dependence upon all these know, moments of mind, none of which are exactly the same, but they have some similar characteristics. When you think about your anger like that, it appears totally different, doesn't it? You know, there's some space, your mind's relaxed, you know, you don't develop this, you know, this identity of I'm this horrible person with this, you know, bag of, you know, repressed anger I'm carrying around with me for the last 85 years, you know. Instead, it's just, you know, mind moments that have similar characteristics. Independence upon that, we label anger. We say anger is arisen. But you can't look anywhere in any of that and find something that from its own side is anger. Okay? So this takes a little bit of thinking, you know, because we're not used to thinking in this way. Yeah? But everything we look at, you know, to kind of take the label and then scratch a little bit. And what am I labeling this independence upon? And is the thing I'm labeling there in the base? No. And it's not. Yet, things still function, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Conventionally, we can still say, I'm angry. Okay. But you see what happens is independence upon those mind moments. We gave the label anger, and then we forgot that we gave the label anger. And instead, we thought that the anger came from the side of those mind moments. Okay? So this is where we got really confused. Okay? We didn't realize that we imputed it, and instead we think that the object's coming from its own side. So it's kind of like, what's a good example? Isn't there some kind of like monster movie where you create the monster and then the monster comes back and then you forgot you created it and it comes back and haunts you? You know? I don't know. I'm sure we can invent some kind of... But that's exactly what happens. You know, we projected something there and then forgot that we projected it. Yeah? Or we projected it and then, you know, we forgot we projected it and then thought there was something really there from its own side and then got trapped by the whole thing. Okay? Yeah.
Okay, I just see if I'm sort of clear on this. The mind that's being labeled, okay, it is because that the mind does not exist that therefore karma moves on to the next life.
The mind exists.
Okay. But what I'm saying is, because I'm trying to think of it like as a non, you know, corporeal thing, as something that's not there.
Uh-huh.
But not even ethereal, because the ethereal would even imply something's there.
Yeah.
But so, that, it's the karma that is the, that has the, that keeps the continuity going, correct?
It's the mere eye.
I'm sorry, for cyclic existence, the karma is...
Karma is one factor in producing cyclic existence.
Okay. So, for whatever it, mind or whatever it is, it exists, it's still an impermanence, but it exists... I'm trying to grasp on something, but I don't know what I'm trying to...
Okay, can I say something that might be an answer? We have to, there's two truths, okay? Ultimate truth and conventional truth, yeah? We can also speak of two ways of existing, ultimately existing and conventionally existing. Actually, ultimately existing is non-existent. Okay? Yeah? But what we're saying is, okay, anger, the mind, the Mississippi, these things exist conventionally simply because in a conventional relative way we all agreed on certain bases to give certain names. And they function based on that. So they conventionally exist. But if we start to look for something in them that is ultimately existent, we can't find anything that's ultimately existent. Ultimate existence is findable existence. Okay? If for something to exist ultimately, it means you have to be able to find it when you do ultimate analysis. Ultimate analysis is when you're searching for what exactly is that thing. Okay? Conventional analysis is you come in the room and you say, where's the cushion? Okay? You're just conventionally looking around, where's the cushion? Here's the cushion. That functions. Ultimate analysis is we're asking, what really is the cushion? What really is it? Does it have any ultimate existence that's findable when we question and investigate and try and find its essence? When we do that, we don't find any cushion. Okay? All we find is the emptiness, the lack, the absence of any kind of inherently existent cushion.
So the mind, that's an ultimate existence because it's a finite? No.
No.
Okay.
Nothing ultimately exists. Even emptiness doesn't ultimately exist. Because ultimate existence would mean you should be able to find something there when you're inquiring what really is this object. So if the mind were ultimately existent, we should be able to find something that is the mind that we can draw a line around, you know, and say, this is it. Okay. The problem with identifying one thing as being the labeled object is that that excludes everything else from having anything else to do with the object. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, for example, if we're looking at the person, yeah, what really is the person? If we say the mental consciousness is the person, you know, we search everywhere, we find this mental consciousness, this is the person. If we said that, then that would mean that the body would have nothing to do with the person. And that would mean when we said, I'm walking, it wouldn't refer to the body moving. It would mean that the mind is doing the walking because the mind, that mental consciousness, is the real thing that's me, so I'm walking means my mental consciousness is walking. That's absurd, isn't it? Okay. So, or you're stuck saying that, okay, my mental consciousness is one I, is one person. My feeling aggregate is a person. My discernment aggregate is a person. My body is a person. My volitional, my compositional aggregate is a person. Then you have five people there. Yeah, split personality. You know? But none of them can really function as a person. Because a body alone can't function as a person. None of the aggregates alone can function as a person. Okay? So when we're searching to find something that really is the person, we can't find anything there. Yet, when we aren't doing the ultimate analysis, and we're just dealing on a conventional level, it's perfectly all right, independence upon a body and mind that are hanging out together, to say, there's a person. Okay? So things exist conventionally, relatively based on labels, but they do not exist ultimately. And even emptiness itself, okay, emptiness is what is there when you search for the object. Yeah. Emptiness is what's actually found by that wisdom analyzing the ultimate. Even emptiness itself is not some kind of absolute phenomena, okay? Because emptiness too exists by being merely labeled. Emptiness is the ultimate truth. It's what you find when you are doing the analysis. But emptiness does not exist ultimately, because if it existed ultimately, it would mean that you could find emptiness when you searched for emptiness. You see, when you search for the table, you find the emptiness of the table. When you search for emptiness, you find the emptiness of emptiness. You don't find something there that's really emptiness.
Emptiness arises from it's also a depending arise.
Yeah.
But what does it depend?
Emptiness exists also by being merely labeled. That's the only way anything exists, is by being merely labeled. Anything that exists beyond what is merely labeled is ultimately existing. And ultimate existence doesn't exist at all. Okay? So this is it's a tricky thing, but you can see why it's important to understand this, because sometimes we'll go through and we'll think about emptiness. And what's also very tricky is sometimes in the early days, instead of saying ultimate truth, they said absolute truth. Emptiness is an absolute truth. That's really a very misleading translation, because when we hear the word absolute, we get this idea of it's absolute, it's independent there by itself. So everything else is dependent, and emptiness is this independent absolute truth out there. Okay? And it's not. Yeah. It exists also by being merely labeled. It also exists conventionally. When you analyze to find emptiness, what really is emptiness, you only find the emptiness of emptiness. So that makes our ego mind really uncomfortable, because we really want something to be there. At the end of the day, we want something to, even if it's emptiness, we want something, we want to find something. Okay? And this is a big problem when it's quite interesting. You know, when Nagarjuna wrote, when he wrote Fundamental Wisdom and everything, it was because the people at his time were falling to the side of absolutism and thinking that there was really inherent existence. There was a real person, you know, that went from life to life. There's a real inherent existence. So he wrote to refute that. At the time of Lama Tsongkhapa in Tibet, some of the early Tibetans were falling to the extreme of nihilism, okay, and saying that either emptiness was an absolute and was inherently existent, or some of them said emptiness doesn't exist at all, okay. So there was, and our people, you know, very much going towards the nihilistic side during the time of Lama Tsongkhapa. So he wrote to try and bring people back, you know, in the middle somewhere here. Yeah. But what's very, very interesting is, you know, because Nagarjuna is trying to deal with the absolutists and Lama Tsongkhapa is dealing with the nihilists, but the arguments they use to disprove both those extremes are pretty much the same. And you find that when you study it, yeah, that you can see that how it's so easy to flip from being an absolutist to being a nihilist, because you say, if it exists, it must inherently exist. Okay? Then you analyze, you don't find anything. So then you go, nothing exists whatsoever. Okay? And that's because you're thinking, if it exists, it must inherently exist. And if you don't find anything when you analyze, then there's nothing there. There's no existence at all. Okay? So you see how the two extremes are related to each other? They're both very strongly related to grasping at inherent existence. And confusing inherent existence with conventional existence, and confusing emptiness with total non-existence. But we'll get into that more tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah. You were, according to your example, your analogy of floating boots on the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
And what does it really symbolize? Do you mean a phenomenon of karma or manifestation of karma?
Okay. So what does the leaf symbolize in the analogy? It symbolizes a karmic seed, yeah? So it's just a seed. You do an action, and that energy trace that's left, yeah? So that's what the leaf represents in the analogy.
So, can we say the problem of belief is nothing to do with time, it's just its nature?
I don't understand. The we act, the action finishes.
If a human being, when we say a karma, we must be have a mind and a motivation and action.
A karma is the action itself. Okay, the karma is the action itself. Sometimes the way we use the word karma is a bit confusing. Sometimes we use the word karma to refer to the karmic seed. Sometimes we use the word karma to refer to the karmic result. But in actuality, the word karma should apply just to the action. The action produces a karmic seed. That seed, you know, it's an impermanent phenomenon, it's not inherently existent, but it, you know, in conventional language, and this is only conventional language, we say that the seed, you know, is attached or placed on the mind stream and then continues on. And so that's how, we experience the results of what we did in the past. Okay? You getting it? So the leaf fell in the river up here. The leaf is changing moment by moment. Okay? But the leaf can be carried here. So Minnesota represents, let's say, 15 eons ago. Yeah? And then Iowa is 13 eons ago. And by the time you get to St. Louis, it's 5 eons ago. And Mississippi is today. Okay? So there's a continuity. The Mississippi is there. There's a continuity, but there's nothing findable in the Mississippi. And the leaf was the, you know, the action that you did, what did I say, 13 eons ago? 15, whatever, however many eons ago you did it. That was that action, okay? But so that seed kind of been there floating along all that time. But then it's only now when it gets down to New Orleans, now let's say this present moment, that all the causes and conditions have come together for it to produce a result. Okay?
Yeah. I had kind of a comment. I was thinking about Resnick's clinical psychology and how it conceptualized suffering and how it tends to really grasp on. When a person comes in, the first thing they're trying to do is make a diagnosis of this is it.
Yeah.
And then you gave a treatment on saying, this is it.
Yeah.
And that label can be so dangerous. Mm-hmm. And then you're doing research trying to find out the most effective treatment based on what is it.
Yeah.
And it's the amount of suffering that they ate and the result of that is just phenomenal.
Yeah. I think that's a very good observation in psychology, how we're looking for a diagnosis. And have you noticed, there's in the whatever book they have, the fourth edition of DSM-4, okay. You know, there's all sorts of new mental disorders that we've discovered over the years, as if they've always been there. But what's actually happened is we've just taken a bunch of symptoms and given them a name. But then we forget that it's just a bunch of symptoms, and we think that there's a disorder or an illness there from its own side. Yeah, and then that's what leads us, as soon as somebody gets a diagnosis, we forget that it's just a convenient label, so that you don't have to list every symptom out every time. But instead you think, oh, that person has that disorder. You know, there it is, kind of inside them. No. And that is dangerous, because then you can develop a whole identity based on the disorder, can't you? And then we start psychoanalyzing everybody, don't we? Oh, that person, they're borderline, that's why they do what they do. And we think we understand them. Lama Zopa said once, and it really struck me, he said, most of our education is learning about labels. Yeah? Isn't that true? I mean, it really hit me when he said that. It's like, wow, that's basically our whole entire education is learning labels. And then we forgot that it's only labels and we think there's real things there. Like even if somebody gets a disease, cancer, we think of cancer, there it is. you know, cancer is just a bunch of cells. What's labeled independence upon a bunch of cells? But we reify everything.
And you were using the logic of reasoning to kind of challenge that. And I was wondering at some point that you would get into it. I forget how to exactly say it. You can either have multiple, you know, cells, or it all has to be...
Yeah, right. Okay, that's part of the four-point analysis.
Okay.
Yeah. I wasn't intending on teaching emptiness during this morning talk. Somehow, that's what's happening. I mean, I was intending this to kind of be more of an introduction to what Tenzin Rinpoche said. And I know, you know, in the first chapter, there's a lot about emptiness there, but somehow this is happening. Yeah?
I'm wondering about thinking.
Uh-huh.
And if the truth really could ever be found by thinking, because the thinking, every time a thought arises, a sense of self arises. And if you're trying to find emptiness, it just seems like, then I'd wonder about that saying, be still and know I am God,
mm-hmm.
Be still and know I am Buddha.
Okay. Okay, so you're asking about thinking. You know, the sense of self doesn't necessarily arise. The self-grasping doesn't necessarily arise every time there's thought. But the thing is that to understand emptiness, first we have to use the conceptual mind, and then we have to go beyond the conceptual mind. So first we have to use words. Words are based on concepts, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
You know? To even know that emptiness exists, we have to rely on words and a teacher and all these concepts. And then we have to develop a correct understanding of emptiness and a correct inference of it. And then, you know, develop concentration and samadhi. And then finally go beyond just that image of, or that meaning generality of emptiness, that thought of emptiness, to actually perceive it. But you do have to use words and concepts in the beginning. Okay? Because otherwise, you see, if we don't do that, if we say, just sit there and be still, then what could very easily happen is we get rid of all the concepts, but that doesn't mean that we've realized emptiness. Because emptiness is the lack of inherent existence. We have to realize that what we thought was there wasn't there. So we have to know what the object to be negated is and then prove that it doesn't exist there. But if we just sit there and empty our mind of concept, we haven't even identified the object to be negated. We haven't identified this false thing that we believe exists. So we can make the mind very calm and clear, and this is where people fall into blank-minded meditation and think that they've attained high realizations, but they haven't. So you can wind up in like this very nice blank-minded meditation, mind's totally peaceful, not thinking anything. Sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah, what a relief from this present berserking monkey mind, you know? No thought, just peace and calm. But you can get stuck there for a really long time, and you're still keep cycling in samsara because you haven't identified that the object to be negated and disproven it and developed the mind of wisdom that sees that it doesn't exist. So the ignorance grasping an inherent existence has not been touched by blank-minded meditation. Hasn't been touched at all. Just hanging out there, and you know, in a very subtle form.
Do you think that having continual inquiry, like who am I, just kind of having that going on all the time, is that helpful?
I think asking who am I is quite helpful, mm-hmm. But I think it's even more helpful if we study Nagarjuna's teachings and try and get an idea of what exactly is this object to be negated. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you understand the object to be negated, then when you're asking, who am I? What you're doing is you're looking for that object of negation.
I don't quite understand that, but I'll be willing to just sit with that.
Okay. Yeah.
Coming back to the reflowing down the river and the karmic imprint is up, you know, often when I think about my karmic imprint, it's always there until it ripens. So there still seems like it's permanent. But when I'm trying to think about being changing, so the only thing I can think of being changing is that, you know how they say karma just expands all the time. So that's the change?
Mm-hmm.
Or are there other changes going on?
Yes, if you do purification practice,
right,
you're changing the karma. But that's
from
more
moment to moment. So that's more the, if you don't do anything to it, if it changes moment to moment, it's because of it.
Yeah, it's changing moment to moment because it's in an impermanent phenomena. But then we can make it have this very big changes, you know, by, you know, nurturing it or opposing it or something like that.
But moment to moment is just expanding as a karma. What's changing?
Well, just that the fact that it's an impermanent phenomena, that it's caused. So each, in a compounded phenomenon, in a caused phenomenon, each moment is something new. It's not the same. It's like an electron. Okay? An electron is new every single instant, just because it's a produced phenomena. Okay? Because I think you're thinking of some gross change. The difference between subtle and gross impermanence, the gross impermanence is something like really noticeable, like, oh, it's increasing. But sometimes something just changes the gong changes. It looks the same, doesn't it, from one moment to the next. But it's actually changed. The gong of the previous moment is not the same as the gong of this moment.
And that is, it has, there's some degeneration. There's still some subtle change. We can't see with naked eye.
Yeah.
Something with a karmic imprint, there's still some
subtle change.
And so that subtle change has to do with expanding on the
I don't know that every karma is necessarily expanding every moment. Maybe it's just...
That's one of the properties of karma that expands.
Yeah, it's one of the properties that it can expand. I don't know that everything necessarily expands every moment. I think that's a question for the Buddha. Okay. Yeah. I mean, does a positive karma expand every...
Also increases too.
Yeah. I don't know if everything automatically increases or if it's just that it can increase. I'm not sure. It's a good question to ask. But in any sense, it's not the same in the previous moment. When prasangikas get into this whole thing of the disintegratedness of the action, which is a... I won't even get into that now, but it's another thing that relates back to karma and karma seeds. Interesting way of thinking about it. Okay, last question.
I just want to say changing means that, because according to Abhidhamma text, not a Dhamma factor can last more than one moment. That is the nature of the factor.
In fact, it doesn't even last one moment. It's as soon as it's arising, it's in the process of disintegrating.
Right. So I think that's what not necessarily to be different, but it is just arise and the pass away, arise, pass away.
Yeah. It doesn't. It's a different thing each moment, but we may not discern the difference between one moment and the next.
Right.
Maybe that.
Yeah. It can be very similar because if there's no cause and condition to cause the change tremendously. But by nature it's changing. It cannot last more than 1 month.
Should we sit quietly and digest a little bit here?